Welcome to Adoption Talk by Spence Chapin, the podcast where all the voices of the adoption constellation come together. Twice a month, this podcast brings you conversations with adoptees, birth parents, adoptive families, and adoption professionals as they share their experiences and discuss all things adoption. We're glad you've joined us. Prompted by new research published by the National Council for Adoption, today's episode brings together its president and CEO, Ryan Hanlon, with author, columnist, and resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Naomi Riley, to discuss with Spence Chapin's CEO, Kate Trambitskaya, the state of adoption today, the child welfare system, and issues facing the adoption community. Let's get started.
Hello, listeners. This is Kate Trambitskaya. I am the CEO of Spence Chapin, and this is Adoption Talk by Spence Chapin. I am so excited to have Ryan Hanlon, the CEO and president of National Council for Adoption, the most prominent and prestigious organization in the United States that advocates for the triad members, educates, and conducts research that's very important on the topic of adoption. We also have with us today Naomi Riley, who's an author, a columnist, and a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, focusing on issues regarding child welfare and adoption. Her writings have appeared in publications such as the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and the Washington Post, and she's published multiple books. Welcome, Naomi and Ryan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And today on Adoption Talk, we're going to focus on the recent publication or report from the National Council for Adoption titled Profiles in Adoption. It's the first part of a three-part study to explore different facets of adoption. Ryan, can you speak a little bit about the goal of the study and particularly this first part?
Yeah, really great to be on this show and great to be with Naomi. This research project started after many different conversations my coworkers and I were having with journalists and policymakers, where we were unable to answer some relatively basic questions about who is adopting and who is being adopted. We had a decent amount of information about certain demographics regarding adoptions from foster care, but very little about adoptions that happened through private agencies, so private domestic adoptions or inter-country adoptions. And further, we wanted to know more about questions like motivation. There was a lot being written about what motivated parents to adopt, but there was very little scholarship that could back up some of the assertions that we were seeing. And so we put together a survey where we asked a whole range of questions, not just about demographics, again, about many other aspects of the experiences that families had, the services they received, even the adoption process itself, so that we could get a better picture of what adoption looked like for those families. And it started smaller than it became. And now we're viewing this as really just part one of a three-part series. So at first we heard from adoptive parents. We're currently in the process of hearing from birth parents, and we have plans to hear from adopted individuals as well.
Great, thank you for that. And in terms of the second part that you referenced, hearing from birth parents, are you partnering with any organization, and what's your anticipated date of publication on that piece?
Yeah, we are. We're partnering with an organization called Brave Love, and their primary focus is on serving birth mothers and creating community for them, creating educational resources for them, and giving them a space and an opportunity for them to speak about the issues that are important to them. So they're a great partner. We are enjoying working with them. We've already completed 3 focus groups of birth mothers. What's cool about that is the focus groups were actually led by a birth mother and another researcher, researchers at 2 different universities who co-led these focus groups where they heard directly from birth mothers. And we will then be surveying birth parents, so birth mothers and birth fathers, in the coming months, sometime this fall, 2022, to be hearing from them. We don't have a publication date set yet, but we anticipate having the findings available sometime in the winter.
Great. And in terms of the birth parents who will be participating or who have participated in these focus groups, how are they able to access, this part, or are you casting a wide net? Is it limited to any geographic area or any organization that you're working with?
It's not limited in that regard. We did limit this to the United States. So geographically, we're hearing from birth mothers in the US, and we're hearing from women who made a voluntary placement, as opposed to in a case where, say, a child was removed and then placed for adoption after parental rights were terminated. So these are individuals who voluntarily relinquished their parental rights. But we didn't put barriers beyond that. We recruited through adoption agencies and adoption attorneys, and we got actually a very, very large response of birth mothers who indicated an interest. And then the 2 researchers did a random selection amongst the many hundreds of individuals they heard from there to invite them to these different focus groups.
And why do you think this involving birth parents in the second part of your study is important for the adoption community? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem. So we don't want to just hear from one perspective. And we often, when we're trying to understand private domestic adoption, that impacts many different people. And so being able to hear from birth parents is going to help us understand what their experience was like better than we would learn, say, if we asked the adoptive parents or the adopted individual. And so by hearing from different individuals, all of whom have their own perspective, they'll be able to give us different information, different pieces of information that only they can provide. So for example, we're going to be asking birth mothers about what their experiences were, what services they received, what they found helpful, what they didn't find helpful. Those are questions that only they can answer. And we want to talk to them about for those that have maintained contact with their child, with the adoptive family, we want to ask them what that experience was like, what worked for them and what didn't. And so by giving a platform where we're hearing from them, we can understand how they're impacted in unique ways. And the same is going to be true when we hear from adopted individuals, their views on certain issues, especially policy issues related to adoption. It might be different than the views that adoptive parents have or that a member of the general public has. We'll only really know that if we can hear from them about this.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. So going back to the current research that has been completed, the part one, profiles in adoption, what are some noteworthy findings for you, Ryan, from this research?
Well, one of the things that I found so fascinating was the services that adoptive families utilize after the adoptive placement. And I remember talking with our team about this because we want to be really mindful not to stigmatize or pathologize adoption or adoptees. And there can often be stigma about receiving certain types of services like mental health services. And we really want to actually normalize the fact that many individuals in our country receive that, including individuals who were adopted. And that's not necessarily because they were adopted. It might be because of what happened prior to their adoption, where they experienced you know, for individuals who say were in an orphanage, they experienced institutionalization. They might've had neglect. There might've been some type of abuse that happened. That's, you know, abuse and neglect would be the primary reasons why children enter the US foster care system. And then they're part of that system for generally, you know, multiple years before they're placed for adoption. It can also be that this is a sign that we're actually providing services. So this could be a strength that we can recognize that adoptive families are able to help meet the needs that children have. So if I can, let me pull up some of the examples families report that over 20% of all adoptees are receive speech therapy. But when you look at just inter-country adoption, it's over 40% who are receiving speech therapy. Occupational therapy, again, it's about 20% or more of adoptees, with about 30% for those that are adopted from foster care or inter-country adoption. As I mentioned, you know, mental health services are over 20% for all adoptees, and even more so for inter-country, and the most for adoptions from foster care. Again, adoptions from foster care, they're often receiving services from the state or county. Even after the adoptive placement, they might be eligible for services. So we would anticipate seeing a higher level of service usage for that population.
I just want to interrupt for 1 second, which I just want to say, like, how great it is that NCFA is doing this research, because a lot of the conversation around adoption in this country is very anecdotal. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't want to talk publicly about their adoption, whether they're birth parents or adoptive parents or the kids who've been adopted. And so what you get is sort of these singular voices, either, you know, someone saying it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, or it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. It's ruined my life. And I just don't think the kind of, you know, conversations like one op-ed answering another is very helpful for formulating policy and thinking about, you know, how we can do this better. And so just having these much bigger surveys and focus groups, you know, where you can drill down into these issues, I think is really important. And as Ryan was saying, you know, the things like services, like understanding, you know, not just, this is not a black and white thing, like, you know, either it's all terrible and we don't do anything to help these kids and these families, or we've done everything and, you know, stop complaining. This is a way of really kind of getting into the specifics and saying, okay, like, how many of these kids need this? How many of these kids want this? How many of these kids are able to utilize these services? I think it's a much more productive conversation for us to be having as a country about these issues.
Yeah, that's a great point, Naomi. I love what you said about not just taking one anecdote, you know, and trying to battle it with a different anecdote and then trying to set policy around that. Let me give another example that I think really follows from what Naomi said there. We ask parents about educational experiences of their children. And we ask them, you know, first to describe the educational performance. They had five options: excellent, very good, good, fair, or poor. And then we asked them about educational accommodations and whether or not their child had an educational accommodation. So, you know, for listeners, that might be an IEP plan, an individualized education plan, or it might be what's called a 504 plan, which is generally less structured than an IEP, but it allows for accommodations within the school setting. A very large percentage of adoptees are getting educational accommodations. The majority of adoptees from foster care, a significant percentage of adoptees through private adoption are getting educational accommodations. They're also, according to their parents, doing very well in terms of their educational performance. So this isn't about receiving services and then saying, well, this population's doing really poorly. According to the parents, they're doing great in school. The majority are doing good or better. And then for private adoptions, the majority are doing very good or better in school. And that's not, that's in addition to having some type of an accommodation, or perhaps because they have an accommodation that's allowing them to be more successful in their setting.
Yeah. Just following up on the post-adoption services and support, which seems to be a surprising finding, and how many families are utilizing and finding those services helpful. you know, in your experience, Ryan, do adoption agencies typically offer these services in-house? Do they refer out? And in terms of the public sector of the system, you know, are these services readily available, you know, when you're finalizing your adoption in foster care? And what happens if they were? What would you expect to see with access and inquiries?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a hard one to answer because it changes very drastically from one agency to another and from one state to another. And so one of the lessons for listeners might be, if you're going to be pursuing a private adoption, that's something to really be paying attention to in the agency that you're working with. Do they offer ongoing services? What does that look like for me where I live, working with my agency? And, you know, is there a cost for that? You know, also looking at what does my state provide? So I live in Virginia. Virginia offers post-adoption services to every adoptive family, despite the type of adoption. That's not the norm. Most states, they would only provide those types of services. If they're providing anything, they're providing it only to those who are adopted from the public system. And so knowing in advance what, you know, services are offered in your state can be really important, because if you don't have that offered, then I think it's important for parents to know what their plan is going to be to identify who those service providers are going to be. And you look at our report and others, and it's not always necessarily clear to parents in advance what services they're going to need. So they might go in even knowing they're going to have an adoption of a child with a medical special need. That doesn't necessarily tell them, are they going to be getting speech therapy services? Are they going to need occupational therapy for sensory processing disorder? Are they going to need, and you go down the line, parents often don't know that in advance. So knowing, you know, what does their health insurance cover? What does their agency provide? What does the state provide can be really important, so that they have a plan before they finalize the placement, what they're going to do in the post-adoption phase.
Got it. Naomi, does anything stand out to you from the findings and the research?
I'm interested in a couple of different aspects, and I'd love for, you know, Ryan to talk about them more. I mean, there's definitely, obviously, as we, you know, as a country have become much more an open adoption country, I want to sort of hear more, and I know these are going to be kind of coming from the future findings too, about what the contact has been like between the birth parents and the adoptive families and children. Because I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about that. I think a lot of people still think about adoption as a closed process. But, you know, how this has worked, why so many more families are keeping in contact, and, you know, what the, to the extent, you know, and this is obviously maybe outside of the surveys, but kind of what the adoption agencies are doing that, you know, facilitate that kind of communication and connection. I think, you know, like I said, people misunderstand a lot about this process, you know, what can be sort of decided ahead of time while also taking account of the fact that people's feelings are going to change, you know, as their kids get older, you know, as they move on, as a birth parent moves on in his or in her life, you know, what in his or her life, you know, how much do they want to have that contact? How much does the adoptive family want to have that contact? So those are the things that I was really interested in, you know, so far. And I was wondering if Ryan could kind of talk about what the evolution is like there in terms of this contact.
Yeah, I'm happy to. And you're right. A lot of this is going to come from our future studies as well. What we looked at here was a few different things. You know, did they have a relationship before they did this placement? And you know, a number did. What I think is most interesting is seeing the change over time, where more recent adoptions are far more likely to have ongoing contact, where they're maintaining some type of a relationship. The 3/4 of adoptions in the you know, past 10 years, in the past decade, have had that type of a relationship. You know, you compare that to the 10 years prior, only 55% did. So about a 20% increase, you know, in a relatively short period of time. What's the explanation? I think Naomi was getting at it with, you know, practices that have changed through the adoption community where this is now being promoted. Spence Chapin's been around for, well, how long? Over 100 years, Kate? Is that right?
Yes.
You know, and but you know, 100 years ago, your agency and no agency would have promoted open adoption. We didn't realize that was a good thing. We, the adoption community, decades ago, thought that might actually be harmful. And it was only through the work of researchers in past decades where the mindset started to change, and we recognize this is actually beneficial for everyone that's involved. This isn't just beneficial for the birth mom or for the adoptee. It's beneficial for everybody. And you know, kudos to some of those pioneering researchers who went against the norm in studying this and then promoting this in an environment that wasn't as receptive to that. And it's really changed the tide where now I don't know any adoption agencies that would promote a closed or confidential type of adoption. They there might be limited circumstances where they might say that that's the best thing, but that's not at all the norm. Agencies are going in and they're promoting having an ongoing relationship. And the reality of our current day and age is that you can't avoid it even if you wanted to, with DNA testing, with social media, with the ability that we have through our technology to identify individuals. There's just no ability to, you know, promise or even try to arrange something that looks like a completely confidential or private placement.
You answered
right. And the other thing, sorry, that I was that's, you know, okay. The overall trend is also something that I just keep thinking about a lot. I mean, your report shows obviously a significant decrease in adoptions. I mean, we've seen that on the kind of international scale for a variety of reasons that don't have as much to do with kind of the culture here. But looking at, you know, why we've seen this dramatic drop in adoptions and private infant adoptions, but also just, you know, generally speaking, like what do you think is behind that? I mean, there's so many factors, you know, if you can just kind of talk about that, you said adoption numbers decreased in every state but South Dakota. I'm going to have to go to South Dakota. I know what's going on there, but if you can just kind of talk about what you think are some of the factors that are contributing to that trend, you know, and are they things that are, you know, are going to turn around, you expect, or are we just going to kind of keep seeing this slide?
You know, time will tell in that regard. I do have some thoughts. The report that Naomi's referring to for listeners is the Adoption by the Numbers report. And we looked at the years 2019 and 2020. 2020 is, of course, impacted by COVID and like almost everything else that happened in 2020. And we heard a lot from practitioners and others of reasons why there were fewer placements. We also think we know there were fewer babies being born in general in 2020 and 2021 because there were, you know, fewer pregnancies. And so that I think is a partial explanation of why we saw a dip just in that 2-year period, but the broader trend is still there, as Naomi is saying. And you know, societally, we generally have not had an accurate understanding about adoption. We were hinting at this earlier that you know, often the general public doesn't understand that most adoptions do maintain that open relationship. They have ongoing connection and contact between the birth family and the adoptive family, that the birth mother or the birth parents are choosing who the adoptive parents would be. And they are empowered in a way that they weren't 50, you know, plus years ago, where they were really just they were led through a process without having a lot of decision-making or empowerment for what was good for them or what their preferences were. So that has really changed, but I don't think our society's understanding of adoption has you know,
just caught up to that. Yeah.
Yeah, has kept pace there. And so I think often, and this might be through the portrayals in, you know, movies and other media, where we see a picture of adoption that doesn't match the actual practice of adoption.
Well, it's so true. It's so accurate, Ryan, that the societal views, there's this cultural resistance that continues to exist or permeate the adoption landscape and the community. This past week, I had a sit down with faith-based community leaders in Brooklyn, New York, and just discussing and normalizing adoption as an option for the community. And the response was, isn't that part of foster care? It's still the same, thought that adoption is part of the foster care system. And the response also was furthered by, well, we look at adoption as a negative thing. It's, it's when we talk about children and they literally use this quote, oh, that child is misbehaved. He must have been adopted. So the stigma around adoption, and lack of knowledge and understanding around private, domestic, infant, open adoption is really missing from a lot of the communities and a lot of the stakeholders. And, I think one of the research projects that was conducted by John Knox, who runs the Opt Institute, included a finding that most women who are contemplating their options have their biggest influencers are professionals. And by the way, those professionals do not include adoption agencies, but include doctors and OBGYN clinics, et cetera. What are your, Naomi and Ryan, for either one of you, what are your thoughts on that finding and the fact that, women are not relying on adoption agency providers as reliable sources of information and support, but are relying on professionals? And how do we modify that conversation if we know that they are the biggest influencers in our communities?
I mean, in some ways, I think it's not surprising, just because if you're going to go the step to talk to an adoption agency professional, that's already a kind of a road that you're seriously considering going down. So I do think, and also I wonder, when you talk about professionals, does that just include the OBGYN crowd, or does that also include, clergy, for instance, like as you were saying, you were talking to. So to me, like the question should be kind of, you can educate adoption agencies all you want, but if a woman never gets to that step, I don't think that's going to be the key. So obviously it's focusing on, the OBGYNs maybe, but also I think, the clergy and, therapists and kind of the people, the professionals that, that a doctor might refer you to immediately. I mean, a lot of doctors are not going to refer you immediately to an adoption agency, for one reason or another. So the question is, the people who are kind of influencing, this woman's decisions on a very personal level, and that could be their medical professional, but it could be also like a religious counselor or just a regular counselor. I think would be the way to think about it, more productively. And I wonder also with these women, I understand like that. I was kind of looking at the results of the survey. Like I have to think that their family is having a big influence on them, even if it's not something where the family said, my mother said to me, I should go to this place. I mean, obviously so much of the, not just baggage, but so much of like the kind of, the messages that you bring with you to this subject are coming from the community you live in, the family that you're part of. So those are messages that you've probably been hearing your whole life or been seeing your whole life. So even if like kind of at that point in time, you say, this is the person who advised me that made me make X, Y, or Z decision, you're probably not taking full account of all of the things that happened, in your past that kind of led you to that point, I would say.
So just to respond to what you said about the clergy happened to be on this particular project on the bottom of the list. So the professionals really just included the medical professionals. And
yeah,
I think that, the question that I have for sort of the community is, why aren't the medical professionals just speaking about options? Abortion is being discussed as one of the options for women who are coming to them, but other options like adoption is not being considered or is not being discussed in these meetings or in these conversations. And how do we make that part of that, part of that counseling, part of that session, part of that visit? You know, and from a family standpoint, I think that family influences were at the top of the list, and that completely makes sense. And again, and just learning about these communities that adoption is often confused with foster care, it seems to be almost a pathway of, you know, not considering that as a viable option because it brings into the equation the adversity that foster care presents and the tension, not only for the woman, but the entire family.
Yeah, I think there needs to be a lot more education prior to women, you know, getting in this position, prior to women getting pregnant. I mean, I would almost compare it with marriage, you know, in the sense of, you know, how I think clergy should be thinking about it. So if clergy just wait for someone to come to them and say, hey, do you think I should marry this guy? Like by that point, I mean, either they're inclined to or they're not inclined to. And if they're speaking to the clergy member, they're probably inclined to, like they're coming to talk to the clergy because they're planning to marry this person. But the question is, you know, week in and week out when they go to church, you know, what messages are they hearing about marriage? What messages are you hearing about adoption? What messages are you hearing about your options, you know, as a woman who's making this decision? So I would just say, like, there has to be a lot more kind of built into the background, because if you're just waiting for a woman to kind of get to this point before an OBGYN, who maybe she sees once a year, is kind of giving her a list of things that she can consider doing, I guess I would say, like, by that, I'm not going to say it's too late. I'm just going to say, like, a lot has been missed along the way if the person who you see for your, you know, checkup once a year is the person who is having this much influence over, you know, your next set of decisions, I would say.
Right. And when our community is, you know, not aware of the reality of adoption and what open adoption looks like, they are going to be making decisions like Kate's saying, with a mindset that this is involving their child in foster care or in a system perhaps that they have seen or that they do have more knowledge of, and they're making a decision that, you know, they think is in their child's interest there. And, you know, our job is not to talk them out of that. Our job is to give them better information so they can make an informed decision. And I think one of the ways we can do that is by ensuring, if we're, you know, if we're talking to OBGYNs or adoption agencies or anyone else who's giving that information, how they're giving accurate information that's non-directive and non-coercive, that I think is going to be key. And to Naomi's point, doing that before we're in a situation that if we can call it a crisis, or, you know, there's at least a ticking clock where a decision needs to be made in a relatively, you know, not forever period of time. And, you know, when we're not in that situation, to then be in a situation where we're getting information can help us when we are in a situation where we need to make a decision. So what could we be doing? Could we, in a public school curriculum, talk about adoption in a very neutral manner in part of the family life education or your, you know, sex ed curriculum, where we address what adoption looks like, you know, what that means for individuals in that situation, and even let them know the current practice is that adoptive parents are not driving this, but that really the birth parents are choosing who the adoptive parents are. They can choose to maintain a relationship, that is the norm for what adoption practice looks like in our country.
And I think, I mean, just to piggyback on that, I think, you know, there is obviously a lot of conversation, and maybe this, you know, it's obviously causing some difficulties, but, you know, conversation about a family structure that happens in our education system. And I do think, you know, talking about adoptive families is part of that, and an understanding, you know, you know, as Ryan said, there is always this problem with stigma, like understanding, you know, how this family came to be in this situation, that it's not a secret, that, you know, nobody has to, you know, tiptoe around this, that everybody is kind of aware of this situation, and that people went into this voluntarily and not coercively, and just kind of having that information, like, you know, much earlier on than you need it, I think it could be very useful in terms of making this a better decision-making process for everyone involved.
Thank you both. Going back to the profiles in adoption study, Ryan, 90% of the respondents to the survey were white and nearly 80% identified as Christian. Do you think that there would be any changes in the findings with a more diverse group of respondents?
Well, there would certainly be demographical differences, right? I think there may be. I think a lot of what we asked about were things like their satisfaction with their decision to pursue an adoption. We looked at, it's not in the study, but we looked at attachment rates. We looked at what their process was like. Those aren't going to change. You know, adoption's not more expensive, or the time frame it takes to complete an adoption, an international adoption, isn't going to look different based on your religion. But I think there's an opportunity there if other demographics like this. This is a very highly educated population. Compared to the American population in general. It's a wealthier population or higher income population than the United States adult population in general. So what we can do to ensure that cost is not a barrier might really impact the ability to pursue adoption, especially adoptions from foster care, which are not expensive, to complete those adoptions. But as we all know, having kids is expensive, and being able to provide for a family, it can be that's a part of that thought process that adoptive parents are going to be considering as they're thinking through what they're going to pursue. So I do think if we can reach other populations with that message, then we could see significant changes there. There's also questions about race that comes up a lot. Of course, it's been a very prominent topic in our cultural conversations for many years, and certainly the last few years. And that could look different as well. There's been a lot of criticism of white parents adopting non-white children, and I think our ability to think through that criticism might be helpful as well. And when we have more, say, non-white parents adopting white children, that might help change our mindset. And that does happen. We just don't talk about it. We don't look at it. But certainly that does happen in our country. And I think the more we're able to ensure that this is not just something that is done by white parents, the less criticism it will receive.
Thank you for that. Just going back to adoption by numbers, and this is a question for either you or Naomi. We talked about the downtrends in private adoption. They've been happening over, the last decade, most prominently in the last couple of years. Also, entry into foster care has been decreasing over the last decade. Do you think there's any correlation between the two?
I think it's a complicated dynamic there. If you look at kind of why there's been a lower entry into foster care, there's definitely a lot of pressure on all the states to decrease their foster care numbers. When people ask me, everybody sort of reads the headlines, they think, oh, foster care numbers are up, this is bad, foster care numbers are down, this is good. And I always tell people, the number of kids in foster care is an artificial measure. It's a measure of how we make decisions about when a child is being mistreated. And we can make those numbers go up or down however we want based on the decision. So the numbers that I am much more interested in as someone who researches child welfare are numbers about child maltreatment, abuse, and neglect. And those numbers are not dropping the way the numbers going into foster care are dropping. We're making a decision that more of these kids can be left in their homes. Now, I think a lot of times that's not the best decision. And I think sometimes we are erring in recent years and leaving children in dangerous situations much more than we should. You know, and the other thing that's happening is that, you know, there are a certain segment of kids who are spending a lot longer in foster care, which means that their plans are not changing to adoption. So we have time limits on how long kids are supposed to be in foster care that are set by the federal government. And a lot of states are kind of blowing by those timelines and leaving kids in care, you know, for 3, 4, 5 years, to the point where either we're not allowing them to be adopted, or frankly, you know, their trauma at that point is so great and there are so many problems that it's very hard to find them an adoptive family, unfortunately. So that's kind of where I think the intersection is happening. The other kind of area that you can look at here is, you know, whether women believe that, you know, they're in a very difficult situation. Maybe they have a substance abuse problem. Maybe they've already had a child taken into foster care. You know, in that situation, you might want a woman to consider whether adoption is the best option. Like, it's, you know, it's been clear for some amount of time that, you know, for whatever reason, a mental health issue, a physical health issue, a substance abuse problem, she is unable to take care of a child, and then she's about to have another one. So you might want a woman to sort of say, you know, maybe this is a point at which I should consider, you know, private infant adoption before the state has to get involved in this situation. If, you know, she senses that this child is basically always going to come back to her no matter what she does, you know, she might not make that decision for private infant adoption. She might think, I'm just going to, you know, kind of roll the dice. And, you know, to the extent that these are conscious, thought out choices, and a lot of the times they're just kind of, they're not. But she might just say, you know, well, you know, nobody's really going to take this kid away from me, you know, on any permanent basis, and I'll get my act together. And so I wouldn't even consider the private infant domestic adoption option. So I think those are a couple of ways in which the numbers might be interacting, but it's not kind of a straight line from, you know, parallel the decrease in adoption overall and the decrease in foster care.
That's very helpful. Sorry, I just had a follow-up for Naomi, a quick one. So, you know, it's clear that the system prioritizes reunification and preservation, you know, and you said blows through federal legislation, 15 out of 22 months that ASPA requires you to file a termination of parental rights is almost never complied with. Question for, again, do you know if there's any research to say that reunification and preservation has worked and the children who are remaining home despite a maltreatment report, despite services being in place, are having successful outcomes, or the family has successful outcomes? What's the reentry rate on children who are, you know, receiving preventative services? Because my understanding of Family Preservation, Family First Act, is on 12 months, funding ends and reimbursement ends. So at that point, the family is not eligible to continue to receive those services. So what happens in terms of our understanding of the outcomes for the children and the families who are A, receiving those services? Are they the ones who are then subsequently reentering as part of those numbers that do enter foster care, or just entering, not even reentering? And three, you know, what happens at a 12-month mark? Because the reality is, you know, if you're suffering from substance abuse, are we to assume that in 12 months or less than that, you're going to be rehabilitated and, you know, things are going to go back to normal? So how are we measuring the outcomes from, you know, this focus within the child welfare system? And are we?
Yes, there are a lot of questions in there. And I want to kind of be as brief as I can too. You know, we know there is a high reentry rate. I mean, it varies a lot from state to state. It varies just in terms of, again, the decisions that we're making. But the likelihood of repeat maltreatment is very high, in reunification, and the numbers vary. I mean, it could be as much as, you know, 40% of kids who are reunified then, you know, experience some kind of maltreatment again. And we have to deal with it at that. That doesn't necessarily mean they're removed again, but it does mean that the likelihood of maltreatment is there. In terms of the services that they're receiving, I mean, you know, Family First is, you know, technically for 12 months. I mean, these timelines are kind of really not followed in that sense either. I mean, it's not like, you know, if you have a mother who reaches the 1 year mark and the whatever substance abuse program she's in hasn't worked, it's not as if, you know, they're not going to prescribe another, you know, substance abuse treatment plan. So, I mean, the states use different pools of money, obviously, to deal with this problem. But, you know, what we're not focusing on is the number of months and years that we are waiting for parents to rehabilitate in one way or another. Those are valuable years of a child's development that are kind of, you know, being lost to the system. And so I think that's really important for people to know, because they see kind of family preservation and family reunification, and they think it's an, you know, it's an unqualified good, because however long it takes, this family should be together. When you say something like, however long it takes, you are kind of throwing the child's timeline under the bus. You're sort of saying, like, we are willing to wait around for these adults to get their act together, even if there are other adults who might be able to help this child and get that child's life back on track. So that's, I think that's really the bottom line, is understanding, yes, in principle, we are all in favor of family reunification and family preservation, because, you know, it is traumatic for a child to be removed from their home. But in these circumstances where a child has experienced this maltreatment and where we think the maltreatment is likely to happen again, you know, we should be making decisions based on the best interest of the child and not based on, you know, however long it takes for the parent to rehabilitate. I don't know if that, it doesn't answer all.
It does address a lot of the kind of the core questions around, you know, family preservation and reunification. Ryan, I know you wanted to add something to this.
Well, I was going to jump into your earlier question, and part of this is in response to what Naomi was saying about how states can manipulate their numbers based on their policies. They could have more kids enter care or fewer kids enter care. Neither one is a sign that state's doing better or worse. I completely agree. And Naomi's also written, as have others, about the shadow foster care system, how we are often diverting kids from entering the public child welfare system by identifying relatives. Then they're then being cared for by relatives, but they're not connected to services. They're not connected to supports. It can sometimes be a legal gray area, but that's not long-term serving that child well. It's harder to have good information about what's happening because, you know, by definition, they're not part of the system. But the anecdotes that we have and the research that has been done isn't promising. It's not showing a picture that children are being served well. It's showing a picture that states are diverting children so that they're not having to keep them. It's not impacting their numbers. States are very focused on the number of kids in care. And Naomi's right, that shouldn't be the measure by which we say a state is failing or a state is succeeding. We could have zero kids in care, and that might just be an indication we're keeping kids in a neglectful or abusive, you know, household. We could have, you know, double the number of kids in care next month. That might mean our kids are safer, you know, or not. You know, there's not a simple way to look at this. These are obviously complex situations. Naomi's right. We do often celebrate family reunification, and I think we should, but we also need to keep in mind, you know, what's the recidivism rate? What are the situations where these children are coming back into care? What does this mean for a child? Those timeframes do matter. Naomi was talking about this earlier. States aren't following the federally required. It's illegal. It's the law of the land, but the states are ignoring it. And kids are staying in care longer. The long-term impact on kids is not questionable. There's been an enormous, you know, volumes of social science research showing the impact of kids when they are languishing year after year in part of a system, or when they're languishing year after year in a home that is not safe for them. We continue to focus on the adults and not the kids in these situations, and we're celebrating the successes of adults instead of the best interest of children. And until we flip that, we're going to continue to be in the situation where we are congratulating ourselves, you know, at the state level or the national level, because numbers go up or numbers go down, without looking at how safe are kids, what's the impact on kids.
Right. How safe are kids? How long are they spending in this kind of limbo area, which I think is really just that, that is an important measure for states to be looking at, to say, like, we have kids who have been in care for more than 3, more than 4, more than 5 years. That, I mean, that really tells you a lot about their situation. Often those are kids who are moving to multiple foster homes. They don't have a sense of permanency in terms of their, the adults in their lives, and even in terms of the school they attend. And so, like, that is a clear measure. If you have a foster care system where kids are spending a lot more time in there than the federal timelines allow, that is a clear indication of a problem. It's not the number of kids in foster care is automatically, you know, tells you, but if you are keeping kids in a system where we know it is, it does not give them a sense of permanency, it doesn't give them a sense of that they can depend on the adults around them, we know that that is having a long-term effect on their development. And so that is that along with child maltreatment rates and repeat maltreatment rates, as you mentioned, Kate, is a clear measure of something we should be looking at.
Yeah, I mean, I can go on and on with so many questions, but I'm gonna just tie this up together with one last question. You know, I know that, you know, the focus in child welfare today, you both brought this up, and we know this, is kinship care, reunification, preservation at all costs, focus on family well-being, not the child well-being. And, you know, does this at all have anything to do with the poor recruitment efforts of good foster homes and a history of, you know, foster homes that have failed, foster parents that have not been able to maintain, for example, a placement that may have been challenging, or a child that may have come in with behavioral issues, or commit to adoption, which of course is not a requirement. But if you're a foster parent and you're pre-adoptive and you get a placement, but you can't move forward, you know, then that child gets removed from your home, and that becomes traumatic, and that becomes a red flag for child protective agencies. So the question is, how do foster parent recruitment in the last decade or the last 5 years impact these programs, if at all, or creation of these programs?
I'll jump in, and I hope to hear from Naomi as well. You know, both recruitment and retention of foster parents is a big problem. I want to be quick to not blame the foster parents or the workers at that direct level within the child welfare system. These systems are chronically underfunded for the mandates that we put on them. And so they have very difficult tasks of seeking to handle problems that they don't have the resources to handle. So we can look at the fact that the majority, over 50% of foster parents, get licensed but don't stick with it. A year later, they're not there. 2 years later, very few are still there. And there's a small majority of super foster parents who are doing the lion's share of the work, while we have a revolving door of foster parents coming in and out, getting licensed, trained, first placement, they burn out and they quit. In part, these foster parents report through research, these foster parents report that they're upset with the system, not the kids, but the system itself and the policies and what they think is not in children's best interests. And so the foster parents don't want to continue to participate in that. But they're also working in a system where the professionals are not being retained, because we aren't putting enough resources to help the states and counties provide what we're asking them to do. And so workers are there for 6 months, a year, and then they're off to a new job. And so we've got situations where foster parents are training the new foster care caseworkers because they've only been around for a few months. That's long-term not going to solve these problems. I think recruitment and will continue to be necessary when we don't retain parents. We're not going to retain parents until we can have more common sense policies that prioritize the interests of children. Foster parents are very well-intentioned. They come at this, almost all of them are coming at this very altruistically. They want to be caring and providing for children. And when they see that they're in a system that isn't doing that, they're not going to be interested in participating anymore because it does take a lot of work and a lot of sacrifice. And they don't want to be part of a system that they think is long-term harmful for kids.
Yeah, I would echo that. Certainly in my interviews, I talked to a lot of foster parents who just said, like, it's really difficult because you want to be there to help. And then you find that you become almost part of the problem, not wittingly and certainly not on purpose, but that you become part of a system that's broken. Obviously, I mean, I think on a very broad cultural level, I think foster parenting is not something that's normalized enough among the middle class. I think what has happened is that we definitely have a population of foster parents who are doing it for the money, unfortunately. And what I think is, you know, that's not obviously why you want people to get involved in this system, but for ordinary Americans, you know, middle-class Americans who are, you know, not worried about where their next paycheck is going to come from, you know, it's really, it's not something that they know a lot of people who do. So you need communities where a critical mass of people are doing it, supporting the people who do it, like where everybody, you know, we were talking earlier about how there are all these misunderstandings about adoption, how much adoption is part of the foster care system. I mean, people don't understand what foster care is either. So, you know, getting kind of some broad education in community so that everybody understands what a foster parent is doing, so that her, you know, his or her children are welcomed into the community and that they are supported in whatever way they can be. I would also say that, you know, one of the other reasons that, you know, many foster parents have these problems is that they are, you know, dealing with kids who have been in the system and been through the ringer, you know, for so long that it becomes all but impossible to handle these kids and some of the behavior and the mental health challenges they have. You know, if you're the, you know, the 19th placement that this child has had, you know, your chances for success are pretty minimal. And you really do have to be some kind of superhero in order to handle, you know, this child's behavior. So what are we doing to ensure that that child hasn't already been to 18 placements by the time they get to you? I mean, the services that Ryan was talking about earlier are so important for these kids, not just once they're adopted, but also as they're in the foster care system, the educational services, the mental health services. I mean, you know, we have a shortage in this country of mental health professionals, you know, and, you know, people who are making six figures can't find somebody to, you know, to help their kid deal with the mental health trauma that they have had. You know, what are we doing to help these most vulnerable kids get the services they need so that they can adjust to a home, you know, in a way that is not totally disruptive to this family and turns their lives upside down every time someone comes. So I think, you know, there is plenty of blame to go around in this system. I agree with Ryan, you know, the recruitment is important. The education of what is foster care is so important, and getting that message across to middle-class Americans is very important. But then the support, you know, not just of the professionals, but really of the whole community. Like, what can I do to ensure that this person who has volunteered to essentially turn their lives upside down, what can I do to ensure that this person can continue in that? How can I support their marriage, their family, their other kids? You know, what can I bring them meals? Can I build bunk beds for them? Whatever it is. I think this has to be a much larger effort than just a few people who are kind of, you know, martyrs to the system at this point.
Thank you both. Well, this concludes our episode of the podcast, Adoption Talk by Spence Chapin. I want to thank Naomi and Ryan for joining today. I think one of many discussions to be have on not only the research, on the system, on the child welfare system, and on the issues that the adoption community faces. Thank you both.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Adoption Talk. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating wherever you get your podcasts. You can also head to spence-chapin.org/adoptiontalk to leave feedback, suggest episode topics, and sign up for updates on the latest episodes. See you next time.